The measures of civic engagement in Utah reveal a mixed bag. That's the conclusion of a new Utah Foundation report called The Measure of a Citizen, Civic Engagement in Utah. It's the first installment in our new Utah Social Capital series, and the findings of the report raise a lot of new questions. Utah Foundation senior analyst Christopher Collard and I sat down to explore those questions for this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard. Christopher, in September of 2021, we released the first installment in our series on social capital in Utah. Now, this first report focuses on civic engagement. It's called The Measure of a Citizen. What is social capital and why does it matter?
Social capital is kind of defined by the bonds between people, the networks that are built up, and kind of those relationships. How people can kind of take advantage of this form of capital they have. In contrast, you know, physical capital is often thought of as money, you know, so this is a different sort of resource. It's a resource of a network. And so individuals can take advantage of this, you know, networks can help people find jobs. Your strong connections can help you when you're having a hard time, you know, they're the people you can turn to when problems arise, and also they're the people you can turn to help make change in your community. More broadly, you know, social capital can also benefit communities as they have, you know, problems or face disaster. You know, during this earthquake back in 2020, members of my community, some of my past coworkers, my family, all reached out to make sure that me and my family were okay. So social capital kind of is looking at these networks and how they can benefit people, how they can benefit communities. And they're often correlated with even broader trends, looking at participation in government on positive outcomes in family health and other related areas of the public as well.
Now, what happens if social capital is low? I mean, you know, one of the things that we know and we discuss in this report is the fact that social capital has been in long-term decline in this country over the course of several decades. What does that mean? What happens when our social capital starts declining?
So lower social capital levels can often lead to poor economic and societal outcomes, both for individuals as they have less people to rely on and in communities at large. And many times, you know, policymakers, you know, these cause problems that policymakers try to address using other levers that they have a little bit more influence over. And these can represent, you know, severe challenges to the government.
So it could be, you know, now we need to reform our education system to try to make up for breakdowns at the social level. We need to install public assistance programs, maybe invest in mental health, maybe invest in law enforcement interventions as a result of declining social capital, that sort of thing?
Yes, so those are great examples.
Mm-hmm. Now, our first report is on the topic of civic engagement, but that's just one part of this social capital picture we're putting together. We've got multiple reports coming forward on social trust, community life, family health, social cohesion, focus on the future, and social mobility. And we've got a whole lot of different metrics that we're pulling together under each one of those categories. But in this first report, we're only looking at three metrics. And those three metrics are voter turnout, citizen attendance at public meetings, and the number of advocacy organizations. We're looking at Utah over time, trends. We're comparing Utah to the nation at large and comparing Utah to other states, and particularly in our region. Of these three measures, which of them do you think is most important in terms of measuring social capital and civic engagement?
So when we're trying to measure social capital, there's not like a uniformly agreed way of measuring that. People come at it from lots of different angles, and that's what we're trying to do here as well. You mentioned how we're talking about, you know, in the future, we'll be pushing out reports on, you know, six other topics with each with their own number of factors we're looking at. But these I think are useful. Our first one is voter turnout. While it itself doesn't necessarily reflect bonds between people and kind of like building networks, there's a lot of academic studies that kind of indicate that the voter turnout is very strongly correlated with social capital. So while it may not be, it's not necessarily, you know, going out and making these relationships, it is a good measure based on what other studies have found. The other two factors, they have a little bit more of an intuitive grasp. You know, when you go out to a public meeting, there's people you'll meet there. A lot of the professional relationships that I've made have been with people as we show up to the same tax meetings together to see what the legislator is. And we've been able to build relationships as we, you know, discuss what our, each of our organizations is interested in and possible changes in tax policy. And so that, it, you know, attending public meetings, it creates a forum where the public can interact with their government, but also a chance for people to meet each other, meet other individuals who have similar interests.
And then we also look at advocacy organizations, right, Christopher?
Right. And so these organizations are you know, give people opportunities to find other people who want to kind of promote the same changes as they do. Provide forums for people to kind of act together and turn their social capital kind of into political capital as they, you know, try to make targeted changes in their government.
You know, looking at these various factors and thinking about voter turnout compared to the other two, I mean, certainly it does seem like voter turnout, while it might be, as you said, a good barometer of engagement and social capital, it's much less of a social activity than it used to be as we've moved to this more of a vote by mail type approach or some other type of approach, maybe in other places. Whereas it used to be that you convened with people in your neighborhood or people in your precinct at the voting station. Now you're just filling out a form at the kitchen table and not having those interactions. I think about the fact that I have seen people that I knew and chatted with them. I used to see my first grade teacher when I was a young man because she was the one sitting there checking IDs as we went in to vote. But we've sort of lost that. Whereas when you think about citizen attendance at a public meeting, that seems like a pretty potent factor because you're getting out there into the fray, so to speak, as a citizen. Let's move on to the issue of voter turnout. What are the trends in Utah looking like? You know, where have we been? Let's go back to, say, 2006. You know, where were we back then and where have we gone since then and why?
So back in 2006, Utah had some of the lowest voter turnout in the nation. It's not really clear why that's the case, but compared to the rest of the nation, compared to the Western states, Utah was just kind of a low turnout state. That low vote turnout status kind of started to change in 2016. Where Utah kind of surged above the national average. And again, in 2018, where we saw a really robust election turnout, which faded a little bit as we came into 2020. But in some ways, it's not so much that Utah faded in 2020 as much as many other states outperformed Utah, even though Utah in 2020 had the highest voter participation since 2004.
What was the difference between, say, 2014 and or 2012 and 2016?
So during 2014, 2015, 2016 is when Utah really started to roll out its vote by mail system. And so, you know, many people think there's strong indications that vote by mail really helped turn out voters in Utah. Another factor, especially in 2018, was the number of additional issues that people were voting on. There were ballot initiatives regarding funding for education, Medicaid expansion, medical marijuana, and even independent redistricting. So these were topics that people were really interested in, and they were eager to go out and kind of make their voices heard.
So if there's something juicier on the ballot, then maybe that gets people out to vote a little bit more.
Right.
Now let's fast forward to 2020, though, and looking at the mountain states, take Arizona. Arizona, all of a sudden in 2020, has a very high voter turnout. And the obvious answer there is, okay, well, that's a swing state. Arizona was very much in play in the presidential election. And so it does make sense that suddenly Arizona would have a high turnout. But then if you look at the next state up, you know, on the list, it's actually Montana, which nobody would, or few people would consider to be a swing state. And yet they actually outperformed Arizona. And then at the other end of the spectrum, the lowest performing state among the eight states in the mountain region was Nevada, which was, would be considered much more of a swing state than, say, Utah.
So when political scientists look at voting and voter participation, one of the things that kind of factor into their equations is, you know, what's drawing people to the poll? Is there a competitive election that where people feel like their vote is actually going to make a difference? And so that often drives higher turnout in really competitive states like Arizona. Also, but it's, again, it's not the only factor. There's also other factors that political scientists look at, such as how difficult it is to vote. You know, there's also kind of this idea of, you know, is there a culture of voting? While Montana, you know, may not have been the most competitive state, Montana has, you know, over the past always been kind of among the top one or two states here in the Western region. Arizona kind of is not had that kind of has the opposite sort of trend of, along with Utah being kind of a low voter propensity state.
Let's turn to the next item, which is the citizen attendance in public meetings. And as we kind of talked about before, you know, that's really citizens getting directly engaged in democratic decision making and the decisions of both elected and appointed officials. You have the opportunity to convey information directly to local officials. They can be a significant indicator of the level of participation in community life in general, as well as how strong the links are between citizens and their local leaders. And on this one, boy, a different story. Utah has a strong track record here. And as of 2019, the most recent year for which data is available, Utah was number 3 in the nation for the share of population attending a public meeting in the past 12 months. We were behind only Vermont and Maine in that category.
It's not really clear to us. We didn't immediately see a reason why that might be the case, you know, why Utah is so much more likely than many other states to participate in these public meetings, like zoning meetings or school board meetings, or like local planning meetings. I was a little bit surprised as I looked for this to see that Utah was consistently higher, so significantly higher than the rest of the nation in terms of turning out to these public meetings. Interestingly, you know, Utah ranks well when compared to the rest of the nation, but it's only 18% of people report doing this in the past year. That's roughly one in, you know, a little bit less than one in five people, you know, attending a public meeting every year. So it's not a big number, but Utah does compare well when compared to the rest of the nation.
It does seem, though, if you were going to pick one of these three to really stand out as maybe the best indicator from a civic engagement standpoint, the one that requires people to actually personally show up and be part of the civic process is the meeting attendance one. Looking up this at this objectively, if I was going to pick one of these three for Utah to show up strong in, I think this one would be the one.
I think that you're right, that this definitely represents, you know, the biggest commitment time-wise to research the meeting, find out when it is, go there and participate. It definitely represents a kind of a time commitment and an effort to be there.
Let's move to the third metric, which is the advocacy groups per 100,000. Basically, we looked at how many advocacy groups there were in each state. Utah is kind of stagnant at the low end, below average. You know, if we look at it over time, just looking at 2020 alone, Utah was in the bottom 10. That's an interesting contrast. It's not a regional phenomenon. On the one hand, you do have other states like Arizona and Nevada that are even lower than Utah. They are the fourth and fifth lowest states in terms of advocacy organizations. But at the opposite end, the third and fourth top states in the nation are Montana and Wyoming.
One trend that we noticed is less populated states tended to score a little bit higher on these measures, while more populated states tended to score a little bit lower. But there are plenty of counterexamples to that as well.
Right. Right. There does seem to be a regional trend in New England where several of the top 10 states are in the New England region. Vermont is number one. Rhode Island is number five. Massachusetts is seven. Then Maine and New Hampshire. So there does seem to be some kind of a pattern going on there. But beyond that, it's really hard to discern what may be happening here. I guess the idea with the small states look at it is that, well, maybe if you're a smaller state, then there's kind of a fixed number of advocacy organizations that you might have. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, Mississippi is a relatively small state and it has the lowest proportion of advocacy organizations.
Well, also if we were counting the District of Columbia, that would outclass any state in range compared to the number of organizations per person.
Sure. So we do kind of end this report with a statement that maybe additional research needs to be done to untangle some of these things. Like, what is the significance of some of these numbers and why are they the way they are? So, you know, we only go so far in our exploration here.
Well, this report was very, very much just looking at trying to find a way to measure social capital. There's definitely a lot of things to look into, dive a little bit deeper to find out kind of why these trends are the way they are, and maybe what we can do to improve them in Utah. That definitely is potential for future work for the foundation and others.
So, Christopher, if we could sum up, it does look like, you know, on the voting side, Utah is improving, but is still kind of below average as we stand in 2020. When it comes to the participation in public meetings, we've been strong and remain really close to the top. And when it comes to the number of advocacy organizations, it's a phenomenon that we don't really understand what are the underlying causes. We do see that Utah has consistently underperformed on this metric and would say that it would be a good project for someone else to look into further to figure out what may be going on and you know, how much it really matters.
Right.
And we can also say in summary that, you know, among the mountain states, Nevada consistently performs worst. They performed worse on all three metrics. And then Montana performed best on two of the three. This has been really interesting. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thanks, Christopher.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
This has been Utah Thrives, Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.